Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts are Dr. On, clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Xander will do the honors and introduce our guest.
Thank you very much, On. Our guest today is Aaron Kimberly. Aaron is here to discuss his new study, which is titled Experiences of Sexual Assault Among Trans Men, a Feminist Narrative Inquiry. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
It's great to be back. Nice to see you both again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's just jump right in to your study. You went back to school, so talk a little bit about that, but then also what prompted you to research this study?
Yeah, so I started this program a year ago. It's a one-year program, so I'm just wrapping up now. But I started casting a very wide net. My broad interest was in establishing feminist analysis and advocacy for trans men. I see relevance in feminist analysis for us. I started a very broad survey literature review of how is our population doing in general. Different quality of life measures like homelessness, income, poverty. Just to give you a little bit of background about who I am, prior to starting this program, I've been a registered nurse for 17 years. So I've seen, and including working with a lot of trans-identified youth, and nursing is one node in a network of institutions similar to social work in that the hospital is only one node of many institutions, and part of a nursing role is to facilitate movement of our clients through these various institutions and systems and I've seen a lot of trans, especially that trans youth, navigate various systems from foster care to homeless shelters to sometimes incarceration. So I'm very much on the ground with this, looking at how all of this is settling, all the politics and the gender identity framework, which came to us from a very high level and is now settling up to the ground in institutions. So I started it with a curiosity of how is this playing out for trans men's real day-to-day lives as they navigate various institutions and social life challenges. So I found things like a large percentage of trans men who are homeless or are completely avoiding the shelter system altogether because they don't feel safe in men's shelters. And then in Corrections Service Canada data about our federal prison system, there were 21 incarcerated trans men and all but one of them were housed in a women's facility. This is the kind of data that I had been collecting. And then I found through various surveys and small studies that a very high percentage of trans men are reporting being sexually assaulted. And that was very consistent across large national surveys and small studies over many, many years, reporting approximately half of all trans men have been sexually assaulted. So that's been very consistent. I think that data is fairly clear and robust. And yet I couldn't find a single study that asked trans men what happened. There's been absolutely no qualitative research done on it at all. I found one that hinted a little bit at the difference that said that trans men tend to be sexually assaulted by people known to them, whereas trans women tend to be sexually assaulted in public settings in the context of doing prostitution.
Did it surprise you that there wasn't research on this? It doesn't surprise me.
It doesn't surprise me.
Think about it. For years and years and years, people have been talking about how there's a male bias in research, all kinds of research, that the default human being in research has been somebody who's male. And so that wouldn't be us, right? And then it's still not us. Even though we live socially in the world as men, we're still not male coded. And so we're still left out of the research. It's one of those phenomenons that stay with us through our transition.
And that's what I found once I started zooming in on sexual assault research. And I decided to focus on that for a couple of reasons. One, just because that prevalence rate is so alarmingly high and well-established. And B, sexual assault in general is very well theorized. Both female rape and male rape are both fairly well documented and theorized. So I thought, well, this will be an interesting way for me to analyze these assaults, to make sense of these assaults and fit them within existing frameworks. And where does it best fit? Or do we need to somehow adapt these frameworks? Because we are falling through the cracks for exactly the reasons you say. And I think that's why feminist analysis is so important for trans men. I know a lot of trans men are going to say, well, I'm a man, so why would feminism apply to me? Well, this is why, because we are falling through every crack possible. possible. And the patterns of our experiences, oppression still follows a female pattern. Things like sexual assault is a very sex-based form of violence. Perpetrators tend to overwhelmingly be male and victims overwhelmingly tend to be female. And so this is why I think trans men are such an interesting analytical case, because we often pass as men and live our lives as men. And yet these patterns for us are persistently female patterned, including being left out of advocacy, being left out of research. So I couldn't find this really when I looked at feminist rape theory, no mention of us. When I look at male rape theory, no mention of us. But when I look at just the patterns of what happened, and that's the missing piece, is asking, well, what happened? Unless we actually hear from trans men about the context, who are the perpetrators, what was your experience? Without those stories, we can't situate it within any framework. I started looking at a publicly available stories. I found one by Jacob and Elijah on a YouTube podcast called A Transparency Podcast Show. And they both gave detailed accounts of being sexually assaulted by Rose Montoya. So because that was publicly available, I wrote my first paper about that. And that paper was focused on the problem of how do we articulate these assaults? Especially in a case like that, when the perpetrator was a trans woman, two victims were trans men, and now we're trying to wrap our heads around what happened, how do we make sense of this, what were the mechanisms? And you could see them both really struggling to articulate their experience. Jacob even said at one point, and you could see the cognitive dissonance on his face, he said, I had just started dating women and this is what happened. How do we even start to speak of this when it's a very body-based, sex-based form of violence, but our language gets in the way? So it's become a problem of epistemic inquiry. How do we fit this within frameworks and make sense of it so that we can actually speak to this problem? If we can't see this clearly and speak about it clearly, we can't address it.
Well, this reminds me of an experience I had in the mid-1980s, many years before I started my transition. And about 20 years, I guess. So I was in a lesbian relationship with a woman who was very abusive. When I went looking for resources and supports, I didn't find them, not from the police, not from the gay and lesbian community. I just wasn't finding supports. So in the 1990s, when I went to college, I decided I wanted to do something about it. And so I started talking about same-sex domestic violence. I spoke in classrooms where people were becoming certified to work in domestic violence settings. It was in our human services department. And I started just bringing it up. And I got so much pushback from within the community. And it was based on this idea of airing the dirty laundry. We don't even have basic rights, right? We can't lodge in a hotel. We can't dine in a restaurant. We can't marry the person we love. And now you want to go and tell everybody that there's domestic violence in gay and lesbian relationships? And I was like, well, it happens. It happened to me. And there should be resources and supports. When I go to the LGBT center and it says anti-violence project, I should be able to access those services. They shouldn't just be reserved for people who are victims of hate crimes, right? But there was this big pushback on it. But ultimately, I was able to get it pushed through and they created a course that talked about same-sex domestic violence. And I had a whole panel of people that came from around the country and spoke, really advocating for this and how important it was. But it was still not until around, gosh, I was living in San Francisco, so it was probably around the 2010s, right? The 2010s. There's an organization in San Francisco called Community United Against Violence, and it's an LGBT anti-violence project. They put up billboards and bus signs about same-sex interpersonal violence. It was the first time I'd ever seen something so public like that. But that's how long it took. I would imagine that there's some similar, if not spoken, felt idea of people are persecuting us. There's a genocide. What other kinds of things people are saying? The other thing that comes to mind is when you say feminist analysis, I'm like, which kind? Liberal, radical, Marxist, eco, right? Which kind of feminist analysis? But I'm just curious if you've had anybody push back on you about don't air the dirty laundry.
Not on me specifically, but on all of the victims, there was that pushback on their testimony, especially if the perpetrator was part of the LGBT community, trans woman or gay man or yes. I mean, that was a theme that came up for both in Jacob and Elijah's public testimony. But then when I did my study, I did in-depth interviews with three trans men and all of their stories quite different. Their lives are all different. One is age 70, others are in their 20s. But I saw clear patterns in their stories. But that is one of the patterns, is that disbelief from a number of directions. One being the one that you talked about is if it happened to be a trans woman, it's like, well, you can't speak of that because now you're demonizing trans women. But also just on the other end of that is we don't fit the ideal female victim. And that's a problem with women in general, is that especially when it gets to the point of reporting and adjudication, and that if they don't fit the ideal female victim stereotype, then they're less likely to be believed. So we don't fit the ideal female victim, right? We look yes. like men. So that is something that they all said, was that when they attempted to speak to anyone about it, one of them was evicted from their home, accused of transphobia and evicted. But the other two were assaulted by men. And when they attempted to tell people, it's like, well, why would someone rape you? You look like a man. Some of them were sexually assaulted before becoming trans men. So in that case, you're a masculine woman. You're not attractive. Why would someone rape you? Or, you know, and then when they did pass as men.
Part of the issue, too, is if the sexual assault occurs prior to transition, like medical transition to where you look like us, you're just functioning the world socially as a man. Where are you supposed to go for support? Do you go to the support group that has women, or do you go to the one with men? I know this comes up oftentimes with transgender veterans who have military sexual trauma backgrounds. I'm a trans veteran with military sexual trauma background. Where do I go? Where do I fit? Right? Because they have single sex support services and I'm going to look really odd in the other one. And I clearly don't have the same experience. I don't have the same experience of being assaulted as a man like the men in that group do. Right. The other thing is, you didn't mention it with your cohort, but I know that here in the United States, there's a psychologist. I met him years ago, a trans man who was in a really abusive relationship with a woman that he had been with prior to transition, who became abusive after his transition. And then he started networking with trans men all across the United States who had female perpetrators, and was putting together underground network of support and resources for them. I've tried looking him up. I was actually wanting to put you two in touch with each other. And I was trying to do that, but I think he himself has gone underground a bit. I can't find him.
I would love to meet him.
I know in the United States, I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the United States, the legal categorization of rape includes penal insertion, right? But in Britain, at least in Scotland, I would hope that it's all of the UK, the men can be raped if they have the experience of being forced to penetrate, right? There are women who force men to have intercourse with them. That can be considered a type of rape. But we don't have that in the United States. Do you know in Canada?
Yeah, Canada, we have a sex-neutral sexual assault law, so it doesn't require penetration, doesn't require, let alone penal penetration. Sex of the perpetrator and the victim is irrelevant. So they framed it around a model of general assault. So it's considered an assault of a sexual nature.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. In theory, it should make it easier for us to adjudicate these cases if it's irrelevant. One of the things that I saw happen, I did a legal analysis of four cases where the trans men complainants, they'd all been sexually assaulted. And what I found was, again, a problem of interpretation. And that's why I've become so interested in this as a philosophical question of interpretation, because even though we have a sex neutral law where it shouldn't matter in terms of the elements of the offense, depending on whether the judge was prioritizing gender identity or sex in the case, really reorganized how they interpreted the mechanisms of the vulnerability and harm.
Well, that's really interesting. Do you have an example or two that you can share?
I'll briefly tell you about all four of them. So I only found four in a 15-year time period. So these cases aren't being adjudicated. So one was the sexual assault of a young girl by her stepfather, and the girl later in life identified as a trans man. So at the time of the hearing identified as a trans man. But the judge said, because I acknowledge you're a trans man, but because the assaults happened when you were a child, you were considered a girl at the time, and you were targeted on the basis of being a girl. And so I'm going to reason this as the sexual abuse of a girl by the stepfather. So really saw sex as being an important element of the vulnerability in the case. In another case, there was a post-operative trans man who was sexually assaulted by a gay man, where comments made by the gay man made it very clear it was a corrective rape. Told a trans man, I'll show you, you're not a man. And in that case, the judge reasoned it as a male-to-male rape, even though the motive, like the patterns, this is what I mean by when we're talking about feminist analysis, we're talking about patterns and structures of things. And a corrective rape like that is far more similar to the corrective rape of a lesbian than it is the rape of a man. So structurally, it fits female rape, but it was reasoned legally as a male-to-male rape. In another case, trans youth was sexually assaulted by an older man. In that case, there was no mention in the record at all if that was a trans woman or a trans man. So we can't track the sex of that individual at all in that case. And then the last case, it was an immigration case where a lesbian couple, one who identified as a trans man from Mexico, had been assaulted in a homophobic assault. The family member said, your relationship is disgusting, assaulted them and threatened to murder them. So they fled to Canada. And in that case, there was initial misclassification and confusion about gender identity. It was initially classified as a trans woman, and then that had to be corrected. And that became a big preoccupation of this legal document, is just sorting out what is, are you male or female? Are you trans woman or a trans man? So that unfortunately became a big part of this case. And the applicants were very concerned that that would destroy their case, because for someone to understand what was happening for them, we had to understand that they were both female. One identified as a trans man. The case honored that that's how this individual identified, but the legal reasoning, we needed to understand that they were fleeing homophobic violence as a same-sex couple. If gender identity had been prioritized, they would have been a heterosexual couple and their whole case would have fallen apart. And the complainants themselves understood that, which is why they were concerned about this misclassification. So across these cases, it's all over the place. Like, depending on how we use gender identity or sex and how we reason that in these cases really changes how we interpret them. And case law works through precedence. So we have to be able to track cases over time, and we have to be able to see mechanisms of violence clearly as patterned vulnerabilities. So it does concern me that there was such inconsistency just in those four cases of how that was handled in these cases.
And that's unfortunate, but I think that's historically been the case with a lot of cases where the definition even gets misconstrued when data is gathered. So what the police describe and use as words isn't matched perhaps by the emergency department. And that will skew data. It'll cause confusion. You won't get an accurate reflection of that. I am really keenly interested in your work. I say that because we also know that there is human trafficking, sex trafficking, involving young trans boys and men.
Yeah.
And Xander and I have interviewed one gay gentleman and then one trans man who were trafficked. And that has taken a lot of work. One in particular gentleman from Yale, he's done a tremendous amount of work to get people to pay attention. When Xander asked you what people's feedback to you was in terms of this body of work that you're doing, does it vary between the medical professionals versus the mental health professionals? Do you find that they are completely taken by surprise, or that there is an element of some awareness? Because I have found that having conversations with various professionals, medical and mental health professionals, they're not all on board, and some harbor biases that can get in the way. How has that process been for you?
Well, I'm still fairly early in that process. I've presented my study at two conferences now, very well received. They were both interdisciplinary conferences. I won an award at the last one for my abstract. And so very well.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, congratulations.
I think what I'm saying makes sense to people. I know that it becomes politically sensitive when we're talking about sex versus gender identity. My concern was that I would immediately get hostility about making that distinction. But I think when people actually take the time to listen to my rationale and how this is actually playing out in the lives of trans men, my concern is the safety of trans men and making sure we have a good grasp of what's happening and have prevention strategies, response strategies, and that we're able to track this information so that we can do that. So far, I haven't really had any hostile pushback. I mean, I think when I first started the work in my program, there were people that were concerned, like, okay, where is this going? But once I started to actually, I've taken my time to really think it through carefully. And when presented with evidence, I don't see how this is disputable. Like even just thinking about it from a feminist framework. So when you said what kind of feminism, because I'm looking at sexual assault, the frameworks I'm finding most useful is second wave feminist frameworks on sexual assault. Brown Miller, Catherine McKinnon has one of the most complex, sophisticated models for understanding what sexual assault is. When I compare what actually happened from the publicly available records, one really good archive of records, by the way, the Human Rights Watch, did a report on sexual assaults of lesbians and trans men in South Africa. So it has hundreds of interviews and case reports. So from the victims themselves, but also service providers, police officers. So that is a really fantastic archive. And then my participants. And so across all of those, the publicly available, the Human Rights Watch documents and my report, it was very clear patterns. And those patterns very clearly fit the feminist frameworks of sexual assault. It didn't fit. For intellectual honesty, I looked at male-to-male rape frameworks. I was willing to place it wherever it fit, wherever it made the most sense. It doesn't fit male-to-male rape patterns. Male-to-male rape tends to happen most often in institutional settings like prisons or gay men who are, because of stereotypes about gay men, that they're always sexually available. So why ask for consent? So those patterns of male to male rape, it didn't fit what happened to these trans men. So it doesn't make sense to think of it that way. And so I think most people, when, especially if they're a captive audience at a conference where they have to sit through my 15-minute presentation, and when I lay it out, this is my evidence. This is what I found. This is the problem. It's 50% of trans men. These are my findings. I hope that I am presenting that in a way that is making sense to people.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg. And our guest is Aaron Kimberly, who is here to talk to us about his new study, Experiences of Sexual Assault Among Trans Men, a Feminist Narrative Inquiry. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We're back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg, and our guest is Aaron Kimberly. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah. Well, I think what you touched on about the languaging and how really important that is, because it varies from discipline to discipline, right? And so how law enforcement talks about these things, how people in medical settings talk about them, how people talk about them in universities, right? They talk about things very differently. And it made me think not everybody's going to use a term like rape or even sexually assaulted. They might say things like unwanted sexual advances, or I didn't have the ability to consent, right? For whatever reason, people might be using different languaging. And so being able to ask a question in many different ways to be able to capture the most, instead of asking people, have you been sexually assaulted? You know, have you been raped? To just break it down. Has anybody ever touched part of your body that you would consider to be private part of your body? You're breaking it down to those really basic fundamentals and to be able to capture a wider audience, right? Cast that bigger net. It reminds me, if somebody wants to know how many of their patients, in particular customers or clients, if they want to know how many of the people they are working with or treating are veterans of the military, you don't ask the question, are you a veteran? That's not going to get you the right numbers. The question you ask is, have you ever served in the military? Because not all people who serve in the military call themselves a veteran. They are. They just don't use that language. But then there's also things about what we study or what gets studied and what doesn't get studied. And if certain things don't get studied, they don't get written about, they don't get discussed, it's as if it never happened. And I was listening to a podcast recently where somebody was talking about the issue of slavery, very touchy subject. In Korea, they had slavery for over 1,000 years. Try and find a book on slavery in Korea, even in Korea, right? Or how about the sub-Saharan slave trade? There's some written about it. The majority of it is the transatlantic. Certain things get more attention than others, and even literally just the language. Maybe there's a book in Korean that you can get in Korea, but it hasn't been translated. What language are these things in? Because, you know, you were mentioning about South Africa. It'd be really interesting to see, because I know you mentioned before we started recording, going into a PhD program. And I'm wondering if you're going to continue working on this and expanding it and seeing if you can find more examples and then apply that analysis to look at. This is just something people don't want to talk about. And why is that?
Yeah.
Why?
And it's becoming harder to talk about because most people feel compelled or want to affirm us and respect our identities, but something is getting lost in the analysis. And that's the level of my concern. Sex needs to remain available for analysis. I hope trans men, if they do have any negative reaction to my work, I hope that they will become receptive to the idea that the fact that they're female needs to remain analytically available, especially with things like sexual assault and institutional placement. 20 of the 21 trans men were housed in a women's prison with no requests for transfer. The trans women were requesting transfer, but the trans men were not requesting transfers. I hope trans men understand that our safety depends on our awareness that our sex does continue to make us vulnerable in certain institutional settings. To your question about how would institutions respond, I mean, I haven't tested this yet, but I suspect institutions would appreciate some guidance about this because I think they probably feel conflicted and they don't know what to do when faced with these institutional placement decisions like homeless shelters or prisons. I've heard stories from the United States that they're putting trans men in solitary confinement as a solution to this, not because they're violent, but because they don't know where else to place them, and that's not humane. So I think institutions would appreciate analysis and some guidance on institutional placement and how to keep us safe. And trans men, I think, would benefit of retaining their pronouns and have a gender identity. But at the back of your mind, remember that biology does matter so that we can have these conversations. Otherwise, it becomes a huge epistemic problem because language is getting in the way of us being able to talk about these things honestly, where our risk is at stake. So for analytical purposes, what I found very helpful is reclaiming Jack Halberstam's concept of female masculinity, because it allows me to hold both gender identity and self-expression and sex together in an analytical tension without collapsing one into the other. And then we can make decisions about, okay, well, at this moment when in analysis, which of those things is more salient? And I think when it comes to things like sexual assault risk or your risk in a prison setting, I think sex becomes the most salient analytical lens to look at. In the UK, I think it was last month, there was a case of a young trans man put in an all-male psychiatric unit. And I think it was day one where two of the male inmates clocked him as female and sexually assaulted him twice. So this is what happens when we can no longer look at sex-based vulnerability, is we make decisions to affirm identities that aren't safe for trans men.
So we've always pushed, in essence, we meaning people who are determined to make sure that labeling of diseases, individuals, we look for universal language. But we have universal language at some level with gender identity and gender expression and sexual orientation. But it's not, still to this day, it's not well understood. It confuses people. So now you bring this added piece that I think should clear it, because for purposes of even medical treatment, it's important to know someone's biological sex. I think we're in complete agreement on that. But we don't have a universal language for that. Yeah. I'm telling you, it does not exist.
Yeah, but it's so important because males and females have different symptoms, need different medications, or at least different dosages of medications. It's important to know, for the medical people to know this about us.
Yeah.
Aaron, there's a clinic in San Francisco called St. James Infirmary, and hopefully it's still there. It's a clinic that was set up specifically to work with homeless LGBT people, not exclusively, but primarily, and also individuals who were involved in sex work. And so I would imagine that they have a lot of data about this kind of thing, but I would be curious if they would ever share it. I would imagine that people could turn it around and say, oh, it's stigmatizing. I don't think they're legitimate arguments, but I think they're arguments that people would make to keep that kind of information out of the public.
Which is unfortunate.
Sphere.
But to your question of what is my plan for my PhD, I do want to stay with this topic. I want to do my own study, where I recruit as many participants as I'm able and get as much information as and really good data on this as possible about the context, the perpetrators, to really understand this form of violence. I think I did some good groundwork in this program, looking at this theoretically and wrapping my head around what questions need to be asked in an interview to start collecting some really good data. So it may be 4 years before I get that done, but that's my plan.
So in the US, we have the FBI and they profile, and they profile based on obviously all the data over the years. Have you thought about, I don't know what it's called in Canada, I don't know what the equivalence is to the FBI force, but have you thought about working with governmental agencies where they are truly interested in profiling?
That's a good point. I hadn't considered that. And I'm curious how they're profiling and recording this.
Well, and also, you know, An had mentioned about human trafficking. There are a lot of governmental and non-governmental agencies within the United States and all around the world that focus on that. And they're collecting this kind of information. I remember being involved on the board of directors for a human trafficking organization that worked exclusively with LGBT people who were being trafficked. And it's all about sexual violence. But I don't know if they showed up on the records. How was that information gathered and where was it sent to, right? Was the local police department, did they have that information? They have these task forces that are involved with sheriffs and police at the city, the county, the state, and the federal level. And then they have these task forces that are multiple law enforcement agencies working together. But I don't know where that information is stored, because there's probably so much information in there. The stories I heard about the type of trafficking of these LGBT people who are almost entirely being trafficked by other members of our community, by the way. It's just horrible. It's a horrible thing. And so I think that's part of it, is it makes people very uncomfortable to think that a member of the LGBT community is trafficking another member of the community, or that gay men are in relationship with each other and there's interpersonal violence, or lesbians in relationship with each other, that trans men are being sexually assaulted by trans women. But right, I think it makes people very uncomfortable. I don't know why. Is it just taboo? Is there shame? Is it what I experienced with the same-sex domestic violence back in the day, which was like, shh, don't talk about that. We don't want people to know about that. And it's like, well, what about the people who are suffering through it? Where are they supposed to go? We need to talk about it.
There's a gentleman, his name is Michael Seto. He's Canadian, S-E-T-O. Does that sound familiar?
Sounds familiar, yeah.
He studies sex offenders online, and I have a couple of his books. He's fascinating because in some of these instances, there is pedophilia. While it's not classified in the DSM currently, we have hebephiles too, while it's not classified in the DSM currently, but there has to be some element to that as well. I was thinking about that because you mentioned the judge deeming that case of that trans man who was at the time a young female child whose father had sexually assaulted her. So he does do some studies on that. We're probably piling tons of information on you, but you're going to continue doing this work. So see if you can't get in touch with him at some point.
I've taken note of his name. That's helpful for me. Thank you. I've wondered too, when you mentioned the pedophilia part, it's sort of been a longstanding joke that a lot of trans men look like teenage boys. And joke aside, I do wonder to what degree that attracts pedophiles.
Well, it gets coded too, because instead of saying teenager or someone who looks like one, they just use the word twink, right? So we can mask the attraction to somebody who is or looks really young can be masked in a way that's cute. Oh, they're a twink. I remember seeing that in, what was that one television show for a number of years? It was Queer something. It was really popular. And I remember I saw the first season of it, and pretty early in the first season, there was an older guy, I mean, probably 20s or something, not like older, but in a relationship with a high school boy. He was assaulted in the shower, but then they became boyfriends. It gets glamorized in some way. So I've known a lot of trans men who go into the gay scene, right? They want to be seen as men by men. They want to be desirable as a man by other men. And I think they find themselves in some predicaments that they just don't know how to navigate, because it's not anything that, I don't know, it's not anything I was ever exposed to, how to navigate that world. But it's glamorized in some ways.
I just got done teaching a class today on developmental sexuality involving seniors, senior sexual health, the gerontology field. And I was talking about the frontal lobe and how it takes up to 3 decades to get built. That's how I describe it. So it's the last one to be built, but the first one to get demoed. So cognition is the first thing to go. But we also know when we come out as gay, lesbian, whatever, and then also if we then transition, we have to go over those building blocks again. So we experience the pubertal experience all over again, the behavior, the socialization. Now, that may vary among people in ways that that's done, but people retrace, they have to go through those building blocks again and get to a place where they're confident.
Speaking of development, though, I do want to throw in before we have to wrap up, just one of the patterns that I saw in my studies. So again, it was a small sample, so I have to be careful not to overgeneralize any of this, but the fact that I saw patterns even just across 3 stories is analytically significant. And one of those patterns is they all told me a life story in which regulation and the punishment for their masculinity started really early in life as girls, and that they all grew up working class and they all grew up within religious communities. That seemed to be, and this is hopefully that one of the things that I'll try to investigate in a larger study, is it seems to be a perfect storm of vulnerability in these economic precarity, religious moral frameworks that moralizes feminine virtue. When you do that, you start to see female masculinity as deviant and immoral. And as soon as you start to see it as deviant and immoral, it becomes subject to correction and punishment. And easy to justify, because I am correcting you morally, would be the background rationale. So that was the pattern that I found in all 3 of those cases. They had all been corrected in some form as children, and then that escalated as they got older, and eventually culminated into sexual violence. All 3 of them were sexually assaulted prior to becoming trans men. They all said that their choice to medicalize was in part a hope that male passing would be protective, that if the world hates them, if they're not safe in the world, best masculine women, then maybe male passing will offer some protection. But 2 of them were sexually assaulted again as trans men.
We are taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Aaron Kimberly, who is here to talk to us about his new study, Experiences of Sexual Assault Among Trans Men, a Feminist Narrative Inquiry. We'll be back shortly after we play our sponsor's commercial.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest is Aaron Kimberly. Let's get back to the show. So when Xander said that he has known some gay men who then get assimilated into the gay man's world, but they really don't know much about it. You have to be able, to some extent, when you're assimilated in that world, to know what you're up against.
Male sexuality, as you would know, male sexuality and female sexuality are quite different. And our sexuality does change a bit when we take testosterone, but it doesn't become a typical wired male sexuality.
Right.
Yeah, you are putting these young trans men in these gay male spaces. They're completely unprepared for just that raw, unmediated male sexuality that is so different.
I remember when I was a teenager, I had a friend and he was gay. And back then we weren't as, well, I don't think kids are sexually active at all anymore, but there was a period where there was a lot of it. And he went off to some weekend event in Palm Springs, a gay men's thing. He came back a different person. The way he dressed, the way he talked, all of a sudden he had a lisp and he was snapping his fingers and he took on the really effeminate gay mannerisms. And then he was telling stories about, it was wild. I was in shock hearing him tell stories about what he did and what was happening and what he saw. He just thought it was funny. And I was like, it sounds really terrible. It basically sounded he was being passed around, if you get my meaning.
Right.
And so me, I was like, oh my God. He was like, hey, it's such a good time. And I was like, oh my God, that's terrible. You're right. Trans men are walking into a totally different environment, but we could be in our 30s, 40s, or 50s. And we're walking into it as an older person with the understanding of it, like my friend who was 16. And so when you are walking into it with a sense of it as a teenager, but you look like a grown adult, there's this expectation that, oh, you know what's going on here, and you're here, and you're down with it. And so that's how we're going to act towards you in the bars, in the back rooms, in the sex clubs, in the bathhouses. It's a type of rawness, and it's unmediated, and it's not something that most of us have ever experienced before. Yeah. Wow. There's like so many things that we could keep talking about. And I think that's why you're just going to have to come back on the show again, Aaron, and tell us as you're progressing through. You can check in with us. You said it'll be about 4 years. So we'll have you come and check in with us throughout the years to keep us up to date on what you're finding and how the analysis is going. And if there's any changes you've made to that, I'm really so curious now how it's all going to end up. And then what the final thing is going to be, something that sits on a shelf and or something that turns into a really practical tool. Because you said people just don't know how to talk about it. How do you do a rape kit in the emergency room on a trans man? Do they use the same language? Do they understand how to talk with us and work with us? Really basic stuff that probably doesn't exist.
Yeah. So they've done some work in that area, but it's inconsistent. It's not going to be consistent. It's not consistent because training in general, and you know this, Aaron, training in general, and even Xander, you're a medical licensed social worker. Training is done randomly. They meet the requirements and then maybe some. So that training isn't consistent. And now with the administration, it's amazing to me what people will pull back on and not move forward in. I'm not saying they don't address rape. I'm not saying that. But again, training, it's had to be tapered back. And that's a shame because we need more of it.
Yeah. And if yes, training is definitely a gap. Documentation is a gap. Any sort of clear, consistent documentation so things can be tracked. If language is being used on different documents in different places, then you can't tie any of that together. But I mean, you imagine a passing trans man with M on his license presenting to an emergency room. They may not know to screen for certain things if they don't know that he's actually female. We're falling through the cracks on so many levels.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it happens just medically when it's something going into the emergency department with abdominal pain, and then they start throwing the person through a bunch of scans because they never think to ask, could you be pregnant? They just don't ask that question. And then people might even be reluctant to offer that kind of information up. And they might not even know that they're pregnant. But I know of one circumstance where they were pregnant and then they had been exposed to things that were not good for the baby.
In the United States, are you moving towards digital ID like we are here in Canada?
Well, we have what's called Real ID.
Yeah.
Which is a type of identification card or driver's license for people who have that. Within it, it has very high tech features.
But at the airport, they are moving to facial recognition. Is that what you're talking about, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, we're moving in a direction of digital ID here where our card would be digital. So all our information would be on this card. So rather than things printed on the card, it's a digital profile. I think what makes the most sense is to have our sex on our digital ID, our accurate sex, but have different layers of access to that information. When I go to a liquor store, they don't need to know my sex. They just need to know my age. Whereas if I go to a hospital, they need to know my sex. So I think if since we're moving into the age of digital ID, anyway, I think that would be the best solution.
Yeah, we've had this black strip on the back of our identification cards that when the police pull you over, they take it, they go to their car and they swipe it like a credit card and it brings up your information. But I don't know that there's medical information on that. And right. So having it be something that can be used in multiple settings, I think is a good idea. But with those various levels of need to know access, you're right.
I remember in the early days when we advocated for changing the marker on our ID, it wasn't because we believed that we literally changed sex. It was about the fact that now I appear the opposite sex and I want to be able to have some choice about who I disclose my sex to avoid unsafe situations. That was the rationale. It wasn't about lying. It wasn't about I have changed sex. It was about our safety. And so I think that digital ID would get around that if there were just different levels just so that every liquor store owner in a small town, if I'm living in a small rural area, the gas station and the liquor store and the bar doesn't need to know my sex necessarily, but the hospital would. I think that would be a reasonable solution that would probably solve a lot of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. To the point where people would agree with that though, right? There's no consensus within the trans community about that, but I agree with that, definitely. Well, Aaron, again, thank you so much for coming back on the show. This has been really fascinating and we are looking forward to having you back to let us know how your work is progressing over the years.
Thank you, Aaron.
It's nice to see you both again, and I'll definitely keep in touch.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of our show. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg. And our guest was Aaron Kimberly. Until next time, thank you for listening.